that is also AI, right? It's just much more rudimentary than the types of AI that we're hearing about now, especially when we think about chatbots like ChatGPT and that sort of a thing. The big difference then is if you're thinking about spell check, or if you're thinking about even using a Google search, before Google was sticking AI overviews at the top of every search, they're not using a ton of energy, right? Each individual use is not very resource intensive because, at its core, it's not a technology that takes a lot of work to do something, right? It's just kind of the way one AI researcher explained it to me is basically if you took information and broke it down into numbers, because we know that computers, at their core are kind of, mathematical number machines, I guess, and then tried to match up those numbers based on, the word that you've inputted or a search that you've put into Google search. It's effectively just trying to make a match, right? It's trying to see where the numbers are similar. And that is not something that is very computationally intensive, right? Because you're just matching things. You're not creating something new. You're not creating something wholesale. The difference with generative AI is that, as the name suggests, it is actually trying to create something, right? It's trying to generate something. And that is where kind of the resource intensiveness really comes into it. So you hear a lot now about the amount of energy or the amount of water that major data centers are using, those data centers, being used to power, these AI tools, but also other parts of the internet. And really it's that is a big part of the problem at the moment is causing the tech companies to, kind of abandon their climate commitments, all these things that I'm sure we'll talk about, right? But I think that is the key difference, right? Is that generative AI is trying to create something, right? It's trying to create a bunch of text. It's trying to create an image. And just because of its nature, that is something that requires a lot more resources to do. I guess that's the key difference as I would see it or as I would describe it. And in order to do that, maybe is the final thing I would say, that requires, one, a lot of computation. That's why it's really resource intensive, right? And that's why these companies are having to build out these massive data centers in so many different parts of the world now, and they're trying to build out so many more in order to power this. But it also requires a ton of data, right? So to create these models, these large language models, as you were saying, Justin, which is, the kind of type of AI model that is at the core of all this, and basically it comes from the fact that, they're taking in all this language, they're trying to understand it, trying to churn it back out, basically, when you talk about the generation side of things, it requires a ton of data. And so that means that for these companies to create these models, there's only a small number of companies around the world that have enough computation, that have enough resources, that have enough capital to create these technologies in the first place. They effectively had to go out onto the internet and grab as much as they possibly could. They had to grab a bunch of published books. They had to grab movies. They had to grab, basically everything that we have collectively posted on social media over the past couple of decades. They scraped a ton of websites, a bunch of news websites, basically anything that they could get, they took to put into training these models. And of course, they now claim they shouldn't have to pay anybody for taking all of that data. But, massive amounts of computation, massive amounts of data to do this, type of task that these companies think is important, but they also haven't really proven there's an economic case for yet. And of course, we can get to all that too. But maybe that's how I would describe it. I know it's a bit long-winded, but yeah.
No, thank you for talking about generative AI there as well, because we'll get a bit more into that. But so basically, there's this common sort of phrase that I keep hearing when I'm researching AI, and that is that AI is always good.
That was Barry Grounds from Newfoundland and Labrador's The Independent. Find new episodes wherever you get your podcasts at theindependent.ca and at harbingermedianetwork.com. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Coming up next. Releasing bi-weekly in spring 2026, Student Power, a Canadian student movement history podcast, tells the story of on-campus activism and the Canadian student movement with Dr. Roberta Lexier in Calgary. On this highlight from the series finale, Dr. Lexier speaks with Mount Royal University prof Mahanad Ayash about the importance of the Palestinian exception to on-campus repression of student movements. Now, here's the show.
Hello, you're listening to Student Power, Canadian student movements from the 60s to today. I'm Dr. Roberta Lexier. I've been studying student movements in Canada for more than 25 years, which means that one, I'm very old, and two, I'm an expert on their history. In fact, I literally wrote the book on the topic, published by Palgrave Macmillan in January 2026. It is, like this podcast series, called Student Power, Canadian Student Movements from the 60s to Today. You can find the link in the show notes. This six-part podcast series, loosely based on the book, examines key moments of upheaval on Canadian university campuses over the past 75 years and answers a seemingly simple yet ultimately complex question. Why did authorities, university administrators, law enforcement, and the judicial system respond so forcefully, so uncharacteristically to the spring 2024 pro-Palestinian encampments protesting institutional complicity in the ongoing genocide in Gaza? Student Power is a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network, SoCal Canada's progressive podcast community. Find more than 80 leftist Canadian podcasts at harbingermedianetwork.com. This podcast is recorded in Treaty 7 on land stolen from its original inhabitants, to whom I'm eternally grateful and pledge to do my best to fulfill my obligations as a treaty person. Thank you to the Niitsitapi, the Yahe Nakoda, the Tsuut'ina Nations, Métis Nation Districts 5 and 6, and the others who allow me to live, learn, and thrive in this place. Now let's get to it. Over the past five episodes, we've explored various moments of upheaval at Canadian universities from the 60s to the present in an attempt to better understand the response to the pro-Palestinian encampments in spring 2024. We've seen that student movements are, in fact, normal, that they always exist, and that they contribute in significant ways to institutional and social change. But we've also seen how repression has escalated, how universities and governments increasingly turn to law enforcement and other security measures to limit dissent, to limit activism. One reason for the increased repression, particularly in the case of the pro-Palestinian encampments, is what scholars and activists refer to as the Palestinian exception. Mohamed Ayash, a Mount Royal University professor and author and co-editor of numerous books on Palestine, including his newest, Lordship and Liberation in Palestine, Israel, joined me in September 2025 to talk about this particular form of discrimination and oppression and its effects on social justice organizing, especially on campus. What is the Palestinian exception?
They're referring to the idea that we, in spaces like Canada, US, UK, France, that there are these ideals and values and beliefs that various institutions within those spaces hold. They're peace-oriented, they don't want war, they want, you know, prosperity for all and so on and so forth. And they apply those to all these other cases, but they don't apply them to Palestine.
So where does this come from, do you think? Why is there a Palestinian exception, I guess?
So to me, I always go back to what is the nature of the Israeli state project, and it is a settler colonial state. And the goal of the Israeli state is to eliminate a Palestinian sovereignty, Palestinian peoplehood, a Palestinian history, Palestinian, basically Palestinian as a collective political identity. And so that it wasn't just about expelling Palestinians from their lands and replacing them with what becomes later Israeli Jewish settlers, but also eliminating and expelling Palestinians from the realm of history and politics. There was always some global support for Palestinian rights and aspirations. And Israel knew that it needed to actively engage in the elimination of Palestinians from discourse, especially in Western spaces that they need the U.S. to provide them unconditional support. This, to me, is the root of the Palestine exception. Now, how it gets taken up by different organizations and groups and institutions in those Western spaces, that will depend on the specific context that you're referring to. Some will come to it because they have direct relationships with the Israeli state and participate in Israeli propaganda and participate in Israeli state projects. Some come to it because of feelings of guilt, of European anti-Semitism. Some come to it because they have, accepted the notion that the Palestinian is a representation of the quote-unquote Arab Muslim terrorists who does not belong in the realm of civilization and therefore should not be afforded protections such as human rights and so on. So here you find different reasons, but ultimately they are all colonial and racist, to put it bluntly.
Right, yeah. I mean, they're all about erasing a people from the planet and history and all of that. Race comes into this quite a bit. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Zionism was always racist because it viewed the existence of these people, of the Palestinian people, who had rich, complex systems, social systems, political systems, economic systems, legal systems, and so on. It viewed them as a non-entity, as people who should not be considered when decisions were being made about the future of the land, quote unquote. And that form of dehumanizing racialization continued to grow with the onset of the settler colonial project, to now where it is at levels that are higher than they ever have been, I would say. Really, for me, in the 2010s, the dehumanization of Palestinians became so extreme that you knew that a genocidal campaign like the one that we're seeing the last few years was on the horizon. And embedded in this racialization is, of course, other forms of discrimination, such as Islamophobia. You know, this is not an accident that the Palestinian struggle had become seen in Western spaces as synonymous with quote-unquote Islamic terrorism. You find connections with not just Israel, but specifically with Benjamin Netanyahu driving that kind of discourse. He started to see it in the 1980s, as far back as the 1980s. That it would be beneficial for the Israeli state project to align, quote unquote, Islamic terrorism with the Palestinian cause, because that would drive a sort of a natural support for the Israeli project from Western audiences, members of the public and politicians and so on. And this has, you know, unfolded over the last few decades. His plan, unfortunately, more or less worked, and you have this association of the Palestinian struggle with Islam in general, but more specifically with the notion of Islamic terror, which is designed to delegitimize the Palestinian aspirations for freedom and liberation.
Yeah, of course. How do we see this actually play out in Canada, that Palestine is, you know, eliminated from this discourse?
Yeah, so first, I in an article that I wrote a few years ago in 2021, I refer to it more as the toxification of Palestine. And this is important for our understanding of the student encampment, because I think we are seeing a little bit of a shift in the student encampments away from the notion that these institutions otherwise hold these ideals, but don't apply them to Palestine. And now they're like, maybe you don't hold these ideals at all, which is, I think, a more accurate interpretation of what is happening. So maybe we should, I think, move beyond the notion of Palestinian exceptionalism. Nothing is being exceptionalized because these things were never actually held by these institutions. I think Palestine should be seen as the Palestine revelation of the new true nature of these institutions, right? So since the Israeli state project was not able to fully eliminate the Palestinian critique of Zionism in Israel, and since it was unable to carry out a real debate with it, because it would lose, it would lose on the facts, it would lose on evidence, it would lose on logic, it would lose on justice, on reason, and so on, it starts to try to toxify it, to say, well, this discourse shouldn't appear in the first place. And it's not part of what should be considered valid and legitimate political discourse, and as well academic discourse. And academia, despite all the limitations of academia, despite all the problems within academia, its colonial foundations, racist foundations, despite all the attempts to silence and marginalize the Palestinian critique within academia, it has survived there. And not only, I would argue, not only has it survived, but it managed to actually become a very, you know, solid force. And this comes in through the works of people like Edward Said and Rashid Khalidi and many others who, you know, believe that academia should participate in the honest pursuit of knowledge and therefore are going to talk about Palestine honestly. And if you talk about Palestine honestly, Israel is not going to like it. So toxify it is the answer. Make it so that people will stay away from it, will have fear from approaching it. They'll feel something toxic in it the second it pops up. When the word Palestine pops up, they'll just want to distance themselves for it. And you see this appear in many ways within academia. You know, of course, cancellation of events is a very prominent one. severe restrictions placed on events that speak honestly about Palestine, graduate students being discouraged from pursuing research on Palestine not being funded, attempts to censor research on Palestine by, you know, pulling the plug on a publication that was about to get published, and all of a sudden it's not going to get published, so delaying it or canceling its publication altogether. You know, all of these ways in which the toxification of Palestinian critique and the research on Palestine appears in academia. And what I found so, I think, hopeful in the student encampments is that not only have they shown that this toxification has not worked, that they are still willing to do a lot and risk a lot to speak up for Palestine, to speak truth to power, is that they did make that switch. They stopped asking universities, you know, pleading with them, saying, you know, I believe in you, why won't you apply this to Palestine? They shifted it into, if you don't start to take action on Palestine, then I'm going to call you who you are, which is a colonial and imperial and racist institution. And I think this is an important shift and a welcome one, because anytime you name things as they are, you're moving closer towards justice. You know, you can't have justice without truth.
There's an excerpt from the series finale of Student Power, a Canadian student movement history podcast. Find it wherever you get your podcasts and at harbingermedianetwork.com. And finally, broadcasting for more than four decades, Red Eye presents a progressive take on current events produced by an independent media collective at Vancouver Co-op Radio. On this segment from a new episode, the team explain how referendum questions are fueling anti-immigrant feeling in Alberta. Now, here's the show.
I'm Jane Williams. This is the Red Eye Podcast. You can hear our live broadcast on Saturday mornings from 10 till noon at 100.5 FM in the Lower Mainland. In this episode, Lorraine Chisholm speaks with Esra Aru about problematic questions on the planned Alberta referendum. In Alberta, Danielle Smith's government is putting 9 questions to a province-wide referendum in October. These include proposals to restrict social services from some immigrants. In an article in The Conversation, the authors say Smith's immigration referendum fuels an us-versus-them divide in Alberta. We've reached Esra Aru, who co-authored the article with Bronwyn Bragg. Esra Aru is assistant professor of sociology at Mount Royal University. Hello, Esra.
Hi.
Smith recently said that she calls the federal experiments and open borders contributed to Alberta's current fiscal woes. For those of us outside the province, help us understand a bit of the context. The deficit is close to $10 billion.
So the financial difficulties Smith refers to the provincial budget deficit and the resulting challenges in covering government expenses, such as operational costs, salaries, infrastructure projects, and for sure, the essential public services like healthcare and education. I think what is really important in here, Alberta has been experiencing a sharp fiscal shift, because the province moved from an $8.9 billion budget surplus in 2024-25 to a projected $4.1 billion deficit for the next term, and with an even larger shortfall of $9.4 billion anticipated in 2026 and 2027. So the emerging deficit is very closely tied to the decline in oil prices, which has significantly reduced Alberta's resource revenues. Because Alberta governments have long relied heavily on the volatile oil market, falling prices translate directly into lower revenue from natural sources such as oil and gas. As a result, the province faces substantial constraints in meeting its spending commitments.
Now, Smith says 600,000 people moved to Alberta in 5 years, and she blames immigration policy under Trudeau for Alberta's financial woes. Does that stand up to scrutiny?
So first of all, it's really important to note that Alberta government was a very strong supporter of migration under the Trudeau government. Smith's government launched a campaign, Alberta is Calling, during the Trudeau's federal government tenure. And similar to the federal approach, they tried to encourage people to move to the province by highlighting several promises like the ability to buy home, better paycheck, and spend less time commuting. And they also offered eligible skilled tradespeople a $5,000 bonus. Regarding Trudeau, we need a bit context here. Immigration policy in Canada has been shaped by multiple factors, and the process is complex. Historically, including Trudeau government, immigration policies and levels have been largely determined by the needs of the labor market and designed to support the Canadian economy. Back to Trudeau, yes, immigration levels increased significantly, but the reason was straightforward. The rise was largely a response to the severe labor shortages, which emerged during the pandemic and post-pandemic period. A second major factor shaping Canadian immigration is the country's steadily declining birth rate and slowing population growth. Canada needs more people to replace aging population and to sustain the tax base. And we need to remember that national economies are highly volatile within global neoliberal market system. In this context, economic dynamics shift quickly and governments adapt to changing global realities. So in response to evolving economic conditions, prior to Prime Minister Mark Carney, the Trudeau government had already begun reducing migration levels as post-pandemic labor shortages eased. So the takeaway is no, Trudeau government's immigration policies did not cause the economic problems of the Alberta government.
Characterize this framing of recent immigrants, many whom have been invited to Alberta through this Alberta's Calling campaign, and now they're just considered a financial burden.
So the central problem, including federal and provincial governments, is dehumanizing immigrants. So the tendency to treat immigrants primarily as economic units rather than human beings. If we heavily rely on immigrants for Canada's prosperity, then we must also address newcomers' humanitarian needs, housing, healthcare, childcare, education. Immigrants are human beings as well. They have families, children, long-term aspirations. Economic reliance without social investment creates pressures in the system for sure. And second, petroeconomy has been long Alberta government's main resource of revenue to fund its spendings. This is a volatile sector. When it stagnates, revenues decline. So a key long-term strategy to address this problem is to diversify the economy. And third, governments should spend public money in a more strategic and accountable way.
Let's talk about the referendum questions. You say many of them are leading. Give us a couple of examples of the leading questions.
For sure. The first question related to immigration. Do you support the government of Alberta taking increased control over immigration for the purposes of decreasing immigration to more sustainable levels, prioritizing economic migration, and ensuring Albertans have first priority to new employment opportunities? So this is the first question. This creates completely a false impression that economic migration is not prioritized. It has been already prioritized since the end of white-only immigration policies in 1962. And immigration has already steadily decreased since 2024. At both provincial and federal levels, it has already been decreasing. And the part about ensuring Albertans have first priority to new employment opportunities creates a false impression that migrants are taking away jobs from Albertans, quote-unquote Albertans, and they perceive migrants as a threat. In reality, many migrant workers come because there are not enough people in Canada who are available to fill in those positions.
What are some of the other questions that are linked to immigrants? There's a handful of them, right?
Oh, yes. The second one is, do you support the government of Alberta introducing a law mandating only Canadian citizens, permanent residents, and individuals with an Alberta-approved immigration status will be eligible for provincially funded programs such as health, education, and other services? Now, first of all, there is no such thing as Alberta-approved immigration status. This is not existing. And in Canada, income tax obligations are based on your residency status for tax purposes, not your citizenship or your immigration status. Like permanent immigrants and Canadian citizens, people who have entered Canada as temporary workers pay both federal and provincial taxes and payroll benefits.
So while race isn't explicitly mentioned in these questions on the referendum, you suggest that racism is not far below the surface.
So what is often referred to as new racism tends to be more subtle and is expressed through coded language. So even when the term race is not explicitly used, process of othering still remains, but without using the term race.
There's a highlight from a new episode of Red Eye. You can hear it every Saturday from 10 to noon PST on Vancouver Co-op Radio, and find it anytime at harbingermedianetwork.com. Listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. This episode has been brought to you by Unrigged. Learn more about Canada's community of more than 30 progressive publishers and get all your independent Canadian journalism, including news, videos, and podcasts, in one place at unrigged.ca. You can follow us on Blue Sky and Instagram for updates on new episodes, and subscribe to the Harbinger newsletter for a weekly Wednesday roundup from Canada's cross-country community of 89 socially and politically progressive podcasts. We're at the National Campus and Community Radio Conference in Toronto next week, but we'll be back May 12th with a new episode. Until then, I'm Harbinger Director Andre Goulet in Montreal. Now, back to your regularly scheduled community radio station programming.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain, Burnaby, BC.
Hi, everyone. My name is Fahima Jalili. I am the host of Free Voices every Thursday from 3 to 4 p.m. I'm just so delighted and privileged to be on the radio station, and the listeners, it means a lot to us. The motivation, the dream, the action, and all the positivity is coming because of all of you. I just want to simply to say thank you all.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
Wake up, sleepyheads. This is CJSF 90.1 FM.
And you're tuning into Slumber Party.